With all the rest of the county, Gerald was on terms of amity and some intimacy. The Wilkeses, the Calverts, the Tarletons, the Fontaines all smiled when the small figure on the big white horse galloped up their driveways, smiled and signaled four tall glasses in which a pony of bourbon had been poured over a teaspoon of sugar and a sprig of crushed mint. Gerald was likable, and the neighbors learned in time what the children, negroes, and dogs discovered at first sight, that a kind heart, a ready and sympathetic ear, and an open pocketbook lurked just behind his bawling voice and his truculent manner. His arrival was always amid a bedlam of hounds barking, and small black children shouting as they raced to meet him, quarreling for the privilege of holding his horse, and squirming and grinning under his good-natured insults. The white children clamored to sit on his knee and be trotted. While he denounced to their elders the infamy of Yankee politicians, the daughters of his friends took him into their confidence about their love affairs. And the youths of the neighborhood, fearful of confessing debts of honor upon the carpets of their fathers, found him a friend in need.
"So you've been owing this for a month, you young rascal," he would shout. "And in God's name, why haven't you been asking me for the money before this?"
His rough manner of speech was too well known to give offence, and it only made the young men grin sheepishly and reply, "Well, sir, I hated to trouble you and my father. Your father's a good man, and no denying it, but strict, and so take this, and let's be hearing no more of it." The planter's ladies were the last to capitulate. But when Mrs. Wilkes, a great lady and with a rare gift for silence, as Gerald characterized her, told her husband one evening after Gerald's horse had pounded down the driveway, "He has a rough tongue, but he is a gentleman." Gerald had definitely arrived. He did not know that he had taken nearly 10 years to arrive, for it never occurred to him that his neighbors had eyed him askance at first. In his own mind, there had never been any doubt that he belonged, from the moment he first set foot on Terra. When Gerald was 43, so thick-set of body and florid of face that he looked like a hunting squire out of a sporting print, it came to him that Tara, dear though it was, and the county folk, with their open hearts and open houses, were not enough. He wanted a wife. Tara cried out for a mistress. The fat cook, a yard negro elevated by necessity to the kitchen, never had the meals on time. And the chambermaid, formerly a field hand, let dust accumulate on the furniture and never seemed to have clean linen on hand, so that the arrival of guests was always the occasion of much stirring and to-do. Pork, the only trained house negro on the place, had general supervision over the other servants, but even he had grown slack and careless after several years of exposure to Gerald's happy-go-lucky mode of living. As valet, he kept Gerald's bedroom in order, and as butler, he served the meals with dignity and style, but otherwise he pretty well let matters follow their own course. With unerring African instinct, the negroes had all discovered that Gerald had a loud bark and no bite at all, and they took shameless advantage of him. The air was always thick with threats of selling slaves south and of direful whippings, but there had never been a slave sold from Terra, and only one whipping, and that administered for not grooming down Gerald's pet horse after a long day's hunting. Gerald's sharp blue eyes noticed how efficiently his neighbors' houses were run, and with what ease the smooth-haired wives in rustling skirts managed their servants. He had no knowledge of the dawn-till-midnight activities of these women, chained to supervision of cooking, nursing, sewing, and laundering. He only saw the outward results, and those results impressed him. The urgent need of a wife became clear to him one morning when he was dressing to ride to town for court day. Pork brought forth his favorite ruffled shirt, so inexpertly mended by the chambermaid as to be unwearable by anyone except his valet.
"Mr. Gerald," said Pork, gratefully rolling up the shirt as Gerald fumed. "What you needs is a wife. And a wife what has got plenty of house niggers."
Gerald upbraided Pork for his impertinence, but he knew that he was right. He wanted a wife, and he wanted children, and if he did not acquire them soon, it would be too late. But he was not going to marry just anyone, as Mr. Calvert had done, taking to wife the Yankee governess of his motherless children. His wife must be a lady, and a lady of blood, with as many airs and graces as Mrs. Wilkes, and the ability to manage Tara as well as Mrs. Wilkes ordered her own domain. But there were two difficulties in the way of marriage into the county families. The first was the scarcity of girls of marriageable age. The second, and more serious one, was that Gerald was a new man, despite his nearly 10 years' residence, and a foreigner. No one knew anything about his family. While the society of upcountry Georgia was not so impregnable as that of the coast aristocrats, no family wanted a daughter wed to a man about whose grandfather nothing was known. Gerald knew that despite the genuine liking of the county men with whom he hunted, drank, and talked politics, there was hardly one whose daughter he could marry. And he did not intend to have it gossiped about over supper tables that this, that, or the other father had regretfully refused to let Gerald O'Hara pay court to his daughter. This knowledge did not make Gerald feel inferior to his neighbors. Nothing could ever make Gerald feel that he was inferior in any way to anyone. It was merely a quaint custom of the county that daughters only married into families who had lived in the South much longer than 22 years, had owned land and slaves, and had been addicted only to the fashionable vices during that time. "Pack up! We're going to Savannah," he told Pork. "And if I hear you say whist or faith but once, it's selling you I'll be doing, for they are words I seldom say myself." James and Andrew might have some advice to offer on this subject of marriage. And there might be daughters among their old friends who would both meet his requirements and find him acceptable as a husband. James and Andrew listened to his story patiently, but they gave him little encouragement. They had no Savannah relatives to whom they might look for assistance, for they had been married when they came to America. And the daughters of their old friends had long since married and were raising small children of their own.
"You're not a rich man and you haven't a great family," said James. "I've made me money and I can make a great family, and I won't be marrying just anyone." "You fly high," observed Andrew, dryly.
But they did their best for Gerald. James and Andrew were old men, and they stood well in Savannah. They had many friends, and for a month they carried Gerald from home to home to suppers, dances, and picnics.
"There's only one who takes me aye," Gerald said finally, "and she not even born when I landed here." "And who is it takes your eye?" "Miss Ellen Robillard," said Gerald, trying to speak casually, for the slightly tilting dark eyes of Ellen Robillard had taken more than his eye. Despite a mystifying listlessness of manner, so strange in a girl of 15, she charmed him. Moreover, there was a haunting look of despair about her that went to his heart and made him more gentle with her than he had ever been with any person in all the world.
"And you old enough to be her father, and me in me prime," cried Gerald, stung.
James spoke gently.
Jerry, there's no girl in Savannah you'd have less chance of marrying. Her father is a Robillard, and those French are proud as Lucifer, and her mother, God rest her soul, was a very great lady.
I care not, said Gerald heatedly. Besides, her mother is dead, and old man Robillard likes me. As a man, yes, but as a son-in-law, no.
The girl wouldn't have you anyway, interposed Andrew. She's been in love with that wild buck of a cousin of hers, Philippe Robillard, for a year now, despite her family being at her morning and night to give him up.
He's been gone to Louisiana this month now, said Gerald.
And how do you know?
I know,
answered Gerald, who did not care to disclose that Pork had supplied this valuable bit of information, or that Philippe had departed for the West at the express desire of his family.
And I do not think she's been so much in love with him that she won't forget him. 15 is too young to know much about love.
They'd rather have that breakneck cousin for her than you.
So James and Andrew were as startled as anyone when the news came out that the daughter of Pierre Robillard was to marry the little Irishman from up the country. Savannah buzzed behind its doors and speculated about Philippe Robillard, who had gone west. But the gossiping brought no answer. Why the loveliest of the Robillard daughters should marry a loud-voiced, red-faced little man who came hardly up to her ears remained a mystery to all. Gerald himself never quite knew how it all came about. He only knew that a miracle had happened, and for once in his life he was utterly humble when Ellen, very white but very calm, put a light hand on his arm and said, "I will marry you, Mr. O'Hara." The thunderstruck Robillards knew the answer in part, but only Ellen and her mammy ever knew the whole story of the night when the girl sobbed till the dawn, like a broken-hearted child, and rose up in the morning, a woman with her mind made up. With foreboding, Mammy had brought her young mistress a small package, addressed in a strange hand from New Orleans, a package containing a miniature of Ellen, which she flung to the floor with a cry, four letters in her own handwriting to Philippe Robillard, and a brief letter from a New Orleans priest announcing the death of her cousin in a barroom brawl. They drove him away, Father and Pauline and Eulalie. They drove him away. I hate them. I hate them all. I never want to see them again. I want to get away. I will go away where I'll never see them again, or this town, or anyone who reminds me of him. And when the night was nearly spent, Mammy, who had cried herself out over her mistress's dark head, protested,
"But, honey, you can't do that."
"I will do it. He's a kind man. I will do it. I'll go into the convent at Charleston." It was the threat of the convent that finally won the assent of bewildered and heart-stricken Pierre Robillard. He was staunchly Presbyterian, even though his family were Catholic, and the thought of his daughter becoming a nun was even worse than that of her marrying Gerald O'Hara. After all, the man had nothing against him but a lack of family. So Ellen, no longer Robillard, turned her back on Savannah, never to see it again, and with a middle-aged husband, Mammy, and 20 house niggers, journeyed toward Tara. The next year, their first child was born, and they named her Katie Scarlett, after Gerald's mother. Gerald was disappointed, for he had wanted a son. But he nevertheless was pleased enough over his small black-haired daughter to serve rum to every slave at Terra, and to get roaringly, happily drunk himself. If Ellen had ever regretted her sudden decision to marry him, no one ever knew it. Certainly not Gerald, who almost burst with pride whenever he looked at her. She had put Savannah and its memories behind her when she left that gently mannered city by the sea, and from the moment of her arrival in the county, North Georgia was her home. When she departed from her father's house forever, she had left a home whose lines were as beautiful and flowing as a woman's body, as a ship in full sail. A pale pink stucco house built in the French colonial style, set high from the ground in a dainty manner, approached by swirling stairs, banistered with wrought iron as delicate as lace. A dim, rich house, gracious but aloof. She had left not only that graceful dwelling, but also the entire civilization that was behind the building of it. And she found herself in a world that was as strange and different as if she had crossed a continent. Here in North Georgia was a rugged section held by a hardy people. High up on the plateau at the foot of the Blue Ridge Mountains, she saw rolling red hills wherever she looked, with huge outcroppings of the underlying granite and gaunt pines towering somberly everywhere. It all seemed wild and untamed to her coast-bred eyes, accustomed to the quiet jungle beauty of the sea islands draped in their gray moss and tangled green, the white stretches of beach hot beneath a semi-tropic sun, the long flat vistas of sandy land studded with palmetto and palm. This was a section that knew the chill of winter as well as the heat of summer. And there was a vigor and energy in the people that was strange to her. They were a kindly people, courteous, generous, filled with abounding good nature, but sturdy, virile, easy to anger. The people of the coast, which she had left, might pride themselves on taking all of their affairs, even their duels and their feuds, with a careless air. But these North Georgia people had a streak of violence in them. On the coast, life had mellowed. Here it was young and lusty and new. All the people Ellen had known in Savannah might have been cast from the same mold, so similar were their viewpoints and traditions. But here was a variety of people. North Georgia settlers were coming in from many different places. From other parts of Georgia, from the Carolinas and Virginia, from Europe and the North. Some of them, like Gerald, were new people seeking their fortunes. Some, like Ellen, were members of old families who had found life intolerable in their former homes and sought haven in a distant land. Many had moved for no reason at all, except that the restless blood of pioneering fathers still quickened in their veins. These people, drawn from many different places and with many different backgrounds, gave the whole life of the county an informality that was new to Ellen, an informality to which she never quite accustomed herself. She instinctively knew how coast people would act in any circumstance. There was never any telling what North Georgians would do. And quickening all of the affairs of the section was the high tide of prosperity then rolling over the South. All of the world was crying out for cotton, and the new land of the county, unworn and fertile, produced it abundantly. Cotton was the heartbeat of the section. The planting and the picking were the diastole and the systole of the red earth. Wealth came out of the curving furrows, and arrogance came, too. Arrogance built on green bushes and the acres of fleecy white. If cotton could make them rich in one generation, how much richer they would be in the next. This certainty of the morrow gave zest and enthusiasm to life, and the county people enjoyed life with a heartiness that Ellen could never understand. They had money enough and slaves enough to give them time to play, and they liked to play. They seemed never too busy to drop work for a fish fry, a hunt or a horse race, and scarcely a week went by without its barbecue or ball. Ellen never would or could quite become one of them. She had left too much of herself in Savannah. But she respected them, and in time learned to admire the frankness and forthrightness of these people, who had few reticences, and who valued a man for what he was. She became the best-loved neighbor in the county. She was a thrifty and kind mistress, a good mother, and a devoted wife. The heartbreak and selflessness that she would have dedicated to the church were devoted instead to the service of her child, her household, and the man who had taken her out of Savannah and its memories, and had never asked any questions. When Scarlett was a year old, and more healthy and vigorous than a girl baby had any right to be, in Mammy's opinion, Ellen's second child, named Susan Eleanor, but always called Sue Ellen, was born, and in due time came Corrine. When Scarlett was a year old, and more healthy and vigorous than a girl baby had any right to be, in Mammy's opinion, Ellen's second child, named Susan Eleanor, but always called Sue Ellen, was born, and in due time came Corrine, listed in the family Bible as Caroline Irene. Then followed three little boys, each of whom died before he had learned to walk. Three little boys who now lay under the twisted cedars in the burying ground, 100 yards from the house, beneath three stones, each bearing the name of Gerald O'Hara, Jr. From the day when Ellen first came to Tara, the place had been transformed. If she was only 15 years old, she was nevertheless ready for the responsibilities of the mistress of a plantation. Before marriage, young girls must be, above all other things, sweet, gentle, beautiful, and ornamental. But after marriage, they were expected to manage households that numbered 100 people or more, white and black, and they were trained with that in view. Ellen had been given this preparation for marriage, which any well-brought-up young lady received, and she also had Mammy, who could galvanize the most shiftless Negro into energy. She quickly brought order, dignity, and grace into Gerald's household, and she gave Tara a beauty it had never had before. The house had been built according to no architectural plan whatever, with extra rooms added where and when it seemed convenient, but with Ellen's care and attention, it gained a charm that made up for its lack of design. The avenue of cedars leading from the main road to the house, that avenue of cedars without which no Georgia planter's home could be complete, had a cool, dark shadiness that gave a brighter tinge by contrast to the green of the other trees. The wisteria, tumbling over the verandas, showed bright against the whitewashed brick, and it joined with the pink crepe myrtle bushes by the door and the white-blossomed magnolias in the yard to disguise some of the awkward lines of the house. In springtime and summer, the Bermuda grass and clover on the lawn became emerald, so enticing an emerald that it presented an irresistible temptation to the flocks of turkeys and white geese that were supposed to roam only the regions in the rear of the house. The elders of the flocks continually led stealthy advances into the front yard, lured on by the green of the grass and the luscious promise of the Cape jessamine buds and the zinnia beds. Against their depredations, a small black sentinel was stationed on the front porch. Armed with a ragged towel, the little Negro boy sitting on the steps was part of the picture of Tara, and an unhappy one, for he was forbidden to chunk the fowls and could only flap the towel at them and shoo them. Ellen set dozens of little black boys to this task, the first position of responsibility a male slave had at Tara. After they had passed their 10th year, they were sent to Old Daddy, the plantation cobbler, to learn his trade, or to Amos, the wheelwright and carpenter, or to Philip, the cowman, or Cuffy, the mule boy. If they showed no aptitude for any of these trades, they became field hands, and, in the opinion of the Negroes, they had lost their claim to any social standing at all. Ellen's life was not easy, nor was it happy. But she did not expect life to be easy, and if it was not happy, that was woman's lot. It was a man's world, and she accepted it as such. The man owned the property, and the woman managed it. The man took the credit for the management, and the woman praised his cleverness. The man roared like a bull when a splinter was in his finger, and the woman muffled the moans of childbirth, lest she disturb him. Men were rough of speech and often drunk. Women ignored the lapses of speech and put the drunkards to bed without bitter words. Men were rude and outspoken. Women were always kind, gracious, and forgiving. She had been reared in the tradition of great ladies, which had taught her how to carry her burden and still retain her charm, and she intended that her three daughters should be great ladies also. With her younger daughters, she had success, for Sue Ellen was so anxious to be attractive she lent an attentive and obedient ear to her mother's teachings. And Corrine was shy and easily led, but Scarlet, child of Gerald, found the road to ladyhood hard. To Mammy's indignation, her preferred playmates were not her demure sisters or the well-brought-up Wilkes girls, but the Negro children on the plantation and the boys of the neighborhood, and she could climb a tree or throw a rock as well as any of them. Mammy was greatly perturbed that Ellen's daughter should display such traits and frequently adjured her to act like a little lady. But Ellen took a more tolerant and long-sighted view of the matter. She knew that from childhood playmates grew beaux in later years, and the first duty of a girl was to get married. She told herself that the child was merely full of life, and there was still time in which to teach her the arts and graces of being attractive to men. To this end, Ellen and Mammy bent their efforts, and as Scarlet grew older, she became an apt pupil in this subject, even though she learned little else. Despite a succession of governesses and 2 years at the nearby Fayetteville Female Academy, her education was sketchy. But no girl in the county danced more gracefully than she. She knew how to smile so that her dimples leaped, how to walk pigeon-toed so that her wide hoop skirts swayed entrancingly, how to look up into a man's face and then drop her eyes and bat the lids rapidly so that she seemed a-tremble with gentle emotion. Most of all, she learned how to conceal from men a sharp intelligence beneath a face as sweet and bland as a baby's. Ellen, by soft-voiced admonition, and Mammy, by constant carping, labored to inculcate in her the qualities that would make her truly desirable as a wife. "You must be more gentle, dear, more sedate," Ellen told her daughter. "You must not interrupt gentlemen when they are speaking, even if you do think you know more about matters than they do. Gentlemen do not like forward girls." "Young Miss what frowns and pushes out their chins and says, 'I will and I won't,' most generally don't catch husbands," prophesied Mammy gloomily. "Young Misses should cast down their eyes and say, 'Well, sir, I might,' and 'Just as you say, sir.'" Between them, they taught her all that a gentlewoman should know, but she learned only the outward signs of gentility, the inner grace from which these signs should spring. She never learned, nor did she see any reason for learning it. Appearances were enough, for the appearances of ladyhood won her popularity, and that was all she wanted. Gerald bragged that she was the belle of 5 counties, and with some truth. for she had received proposals from nearly all the young men in the neighborhood, and many from places as far away as Atlanta and Savannah. At 16, thanks to Mammy and Ellen, she looked sweet, charming, and giddy. But she was, in reality, self-willed, vain, and obstinate. She had the easily stirred passions of her Irish father, and nothing except the thinnest veneer of her mother's unselfish and forbearing nature. Ellen never fully realized that it was only a veneer, for Scarlett always showed her best face to her mother, concealing her escapades, curbing her temper, and appearing as sweet-natured as she could in Ellen's presence. For her mother could shame her to tears with a reproachful glance. But Mammy was under no illusions about her, and was constantly alert for breaks in the veneer. Mammy's eyes were sharper than Ellen's, and Scarlett could never recall in all her life having fooled Mammy for long. It was not that these two loving mentors deplored Scarlett's high spirits, vivacity, and charm. These were traits of which Southern women were proud. It was Gerald's headstrong and impetuous nature in her that gave them concern, and they sometimes feared that they would not be able to conceal her damaging qualities until she had made a good match. But Scarlett intended to marry, and marry Ashley. And she was willing to appear demure, pliable, and scatterbrained, if those were the qualities that attracted men. Just why men should be this way, she did not know. She only knew that such methods worked. It never interested her enough to try to think out the reason for it, for she knew nothing of the inner workings of any human being's mind, not even her own. She knew only that if she did or said thus and so, men would unerringly respond with a complimentary thus and so. It was like a mathematical formula. And no more difficult, for mathematics was the one subject that had come easy to Scarlett in her school days. If she knew little about men's minds, she knew even less about the minds of women, for they interested her less. She had never had a girlfriend, and she never felt any lack on that account. To her, all women, including her two sisters, were natural enemies in pursuit of the same prey, man. All women, with the one exception of her mother. Ellen O'Hara was different. And Scarlett regarded her as something holy and apart from all the rest of humankind. When Scarlett was a child, she had confused her mother with the Virgin Mary, and now that she was older, she saw no reason for changing her opinion. To her, Ellen represented the utter security that only heaven or a mother can give. She knew that her mother was the embodiment of justice, truth, loving tenderness, and profound wisdom. A great lady. Scarlett wanted very much to be like her mother. The only difficulty was that by being just and truthful and tender and unselfish, one missed most of the joys of life, and certainly many beaux. And life was too short to miss such pleasant things. Some day when she was married to Ashley and old, some day when she had time for it, she intended to be like Ellen. But until then. Chapter 4. That night at supper, Scarlett went through the motions of presiding over the table in her mother's absence. But her mind was in a ferment over the dreadful news she had heard about Ashley and Melanie. Desperately, she longed for her mother's return from the Slatteries, for without her, she felt lost and alone. What right had the Slatteries and their everlasting sickness to take Ellen away from home just at this time when she, Scarlett, needed her so much? Throughout the dismal meal, Gerald's booming voice battered against her ears until she thought she could endure it no longer. He had forgotten completely about his conversation with her that afternoon, and was carrying on a monologue about the latest news from Fort Sumter, which he punctuated by hammering his fist on the table and waving his arms in the air. Gerald made a habit of dominating the conversation at mealtimes, and usually Scarlett, occupied with her own thoughts, scarcely heard him. But tonight, she could not shut out his voice, no matter how much she strained to listen for the sound of carriage wheels that would herald Ellen's return. Of course, she did not intend to tell her mother what was so heavy on her heart, for Ellen would be shocked and grieved to know that a daughter of hers wanted a man who was engaged to another girl. But in the depths of the first tragedy she had ever known, she wanted the very comfort of her mother's presence. She always felt secure when Ellen was by her, for there was nothing so bad that Ellen could not better it, simply by being there. She rose suddenly from her chair at the sound of creaking wheels in the driveway, and then sank down again as they went on around the house to the backyard. It could not be Ellen, for she would alight at the front steps. Then there was an excited babble of Negro voices in the darkness of the yard, and high-pitched Negro laughter. Looking out the window, Scarlett saw Pork, who had left the room a moment before, holding high a flaring pine knot, while indistinguishable figures descended from a wagon. The laughter and talking rose and fell in the dark night air, pleasant, homely, carefree sounds, gutturally soft, musically shrill. Then feet shuffled up the back porch stairs and into the passageway leading to the main house, stopping in the hall just outside the dining room. There was a brief interval of whispering, and Pork entered, his usual dignity gone, his eyes rolling and his teeth agleam.
"Mr. Gerald," he announced, breathing hard, the pride of a bridegroom all over his shining face. "Your new woman done come." "New woman? I didn't buy any new woman," declared Gerald, pretending to glare. "Yes, sir, you did, Mr. Gerald. Yes, sir. And she out here now, wanting to speak with you,"
answered Pork, giggling and twisting his hands in excitement.
"Well, bring in the bride," said Gerald.
And Pork, turning, beckoned into the hall to his wife, newly arrived from the Wilkes plantation, to become part of the household of Tara. She entered, and behind her, almost hidden by her voluminous calico skirts, came her 12-year-old daughter squirming against her mother's legs. Dilsey was tall and bore herself erectly. She might have been any age, from 30 to 60, so unlined was her immobile bronze face. Indian blood was plain in her features, overbalancing the Negroid characteristics. The red color of her skin, narrow high forehead, prominent cheekbones, and the hawk-bridged nose which flattened at the end above thick Negro lips all showed the mixture of two races. She was self-possessed and walked with a dignity that surpassed even Mammy's, for Mammy had acquired her dignity, and Dilsey's was in her blood. When she spoke, her voice was not so slurred as most Negroes, and she chose her words more carefully.
"Good evening, young missus. Mr. Gerald, I am sorry to disturb you, but I wanted to come here and thank you again for buying me and my child. Lots of gentlemen's might have bought me, but they wouldn't have bought my Prissy, too, just to keep me from grieving, and I thanks you. I'm going to do my best for you, and show you I ain't forgetting."
said Gerald, clearing his throat in embarrassment at being caught openly in an act of kindness. Dilsey turned to Scarlett, and something like a smile wrinkled the corners of her eyes.
"Miss Scarlett, Pork done told me how you asked Mr. Gerald to buy me. And so I'm going to give you my Prissy for your own maid."
She reached behind her and jerked the little girl forward. She was a brown little creature, with skinny legs like a bird and a myriad of pigtails carefully wrapped with twine sticking stiffly out from her head. She had sharp, knowing eyes that missed nothing and a studiedly stupid look on her face. "Thank you, Dilsey," Scarlett replied. "But I'm afraid Mammy will have something to say about that."
She's been my maid ever since I was born.
Mammy getting old, said Dilsey, with a calmness that would have enraged Mammy. She a good mammy, but you a young lady now, and needs a good maid. And my Prissy been maiden for Miss India for a year now. She can sew and fix hair good as a grown person.
Prodded by her mother, Prissy bobbed a sudden curtsy and grinned at Scarlet, who could not help grinning back. A sharp little wench, she thought, and said aloud,
Thank you, Dilsey. We'll see about it when Mother comes home.
Thank you, ma'am.
I gives you good night, said Dilsey.
And turning, left the room with her child, pork dancing attendance. The supper things cleared away. Gerald resumed his oration, but with little satisfaction to himself and none at all to his audience. His thunderous predictions of immediate war and his rhetorical questions as to whether the South would stand for further insults from the Yankees only produced faintly bored,
Yes, Papa's, and No, Pa's.
Corrine, sitting on a hassock under the big lamp, was deep in the romance of a girl who had taken the veil after her lover's death, and with silent tears of enjoyment oozing from her eyes, was pleasurably picturing herself in a white coif. Sue Ellen, embroidering on what she gigglingly called her hope chest, was wondering if she could possibly detach Stuart Tarleton from her sister's side at the barbecue tomorrow and fascinate him with the sweet womanly qualities which she possessed and Scarlet did not. And Scarlet was in a tumult about Ashley. How could Pa talk on and on about Fort Sumter and the Yankees when he knew her heart was breaking? As usual in the very young, she marveled that people could be so selfishly oblivious to her pain, and the world rock along just the same in spite of her heartbreak. Her mind was as if a cyclone had gone through it, and it seemed strange that the dining room where they sat should be so placid, so unchanged from what it had always been. The heavy mahogany table and sideboards, the massive silver, the bright rag rugs on the shining floor were all in their accustomed places, just as if nothing had happened. It was a friendly and comfortable room, and ordinarily Scarlet loved the quiet hours which the family spent there after supper. But tonight she hated the sight of it, and if she had not feared her father's loudly bawled questions, she would have slipped away down the dark hall to Ellen's little office and cried out her sorrow on the old sofa. That was the room that Scarlet liked best in all the house. There, Ellen sat before her tall secretary each morning, keeping the accounts of the plantation and listening to the reports of Jonas Wilkerson, the overseer. There also the family idled while Ellen's quill scratched across her ledgers, Gerald in the old rocker, the girls on the sagging cushions of the sofa that was too battered and worn for the front of the house. Scarlet longed to be there now, alone with Ellen, so she could put her head in her mother's lap and cry in peace. Wouldn't Mother ever come home? Then wheels ground sharply on the graveled driveway, and the soft murmur of Ellen's voice dismissing the coachman floated into the room. The whole group looked up eagerly as she entered rapidly, her hoops swaying, her face tired and sad. There entered with her the faint fragrance of lemon verbena sachet, which seemed always to creep from the folds of her dresses, a fragrance that was always linked in Scarlet's mind with her mother. Mammy followed at a few paces, the leather bag in her hand, her underlip pushed out and her brow lowering. Mammy muttered darkly to herself as she waddled, taking care that her remarks were pitched too low to be understood, but loud enough to register her unqualified disapproval.
I am sorry I am so late, said Ellen, slipping her plaid shawl from drooping shoulders and handing it to Scarlet, whose cheek she patted in passing.
Gerald's face had brightened as if by magic at her entrance.
"Is the brat baptized?" he questioned.
"Yes, and dead, poor thing," said Ellen.
I feared Emmy would die too, but I think she will live.
The girls' faces turned to her, startled and questioning, and Gerald wagged his head philosophically.
Well, 'tis better so that the brat is dead, no doubt. Poor fatherless.
It is late. We had better have prayers now, interrupted Ellen so smoothly that, if Scarlett had not known her mother well, the interruption would have passed unnoticed. It would be interesting to know who was the father of Emmy Slattery's baby, but Scarlett knew she would never learn the truth of the matter if she waited to hear it from her mother. Scarlett suspected Jonas Wilkerson, for she had frequently seen him walking down the road with Emmy at nightfall. Jonas was a Yankee and a bachelor, and the fact that he was an overseer forever barred him from any contact with a county social life. There was no family of any standing into which he could marry, no people with whom he could associate except the Slatteries and riffraff like them. As he was several cuts above the Slatteries in education, it was only natural that he should not want to marry Emmy, no matter how often he might walk with her in the twilight. Scarlett sighed, for her curiosity was sharp. Things were always happening under her mother's eyes, which she noticed no more than if they had not happened at all. Ellen ignored all things contrary to her ideas of propriety, and tried to teach Scarlett to do the same, but with poor success. Ellen had stepped to the mantel to take her rosary beads from the small inlaid casket in which they always reposed when Mammy spoke up with firmness.
"Miss Ellen, you go and eat some supper before you does any praying."
"Thank you, Mammy, but I am not hungry."
"I go and fix your supper myself and you eats it," said Mammy, her brow furrowed with indignation as she started down the hall for the kitchen. "Polk," she called. "Tell Cookie stir up the fire. Miss Ellen home."
As the board shuddered under her weight, the soliloquy she had been muttering in the front hall grew louder and louder, coming clearly to the ears of the family in the dining room.
"I has said time and again it don't do no good doing nothing for white trash. They is the shiftless, most ungrateful parcel of no counts living. And Miss Ellen got no business wearing herself out waiting on folks that, did they be worth shooting, they had niggers to wait on them. And I has said..."
Her voice trailed off as she went down the long open passageway, covered only by a roof that led into the kitchen. Mammy had her own method of letting her owners know exactly where she stood on all matters. She knew it was beneath the dignity of quality white folks to pay the slightest attention to what a darkie said when she was just grumbling to herself. She knew that to uphold this dignity, they must ignore what she said, even if she stood in the next room and almost shouted. It protected her from reproof, and it left no doubt in anyone's mind as to her exact views on any subject. Pork entered the room, bearing a plate, silver, and a napkin. He was followed closely by Jack, a black little boy of 10, hastily buttoning a white linen jacket with one hand and bearing in the other a fly swisher made of thin strips of newspaper, tied to a reed longer than he was. Ellen had a beautiful peacock feather fly brusher, but it was used only on very special occasions and then only after domestic struggle, due to the obstinate conviction of Pork, Cookie, and Mammy that peacock feathers were bad luck. Ellen sat down in the chair which Gerald pulled out for her, and four voices attacked her.
"Mother, the lace is loose on my new ball dress, and I want to wear it tomorrow night at 12 Oaks. Won't you please fix it? Mother, Scarlett's new dress is prettier than mine, and I look like a fright in pink. Why can't she wear my pink and let me wear her green? She looks all right in pink." "Mother, can I stay up for the ball tomorrow night? I'm 13 now."
"Mrs. O'Hara, would you believe it? Hush, you girls, before I take me crop to you. Cade Calvert was in Atlanta this morning, and he says, 'Will you be quiet and let me be hearing me own voice?' And he says, It's all upset they are there and talking nothing but war, militia drilling, troops forming. And he says the news from Charleston is that they will be putting up with no more Yankee insults.
Ellen's tired mouth smiled into the tumult as she addressed herself first to her husband, as a wife should. If the Nass people of Charleston feel that way, I'm sure we will all feel the same way soon, she said. For she had a deeply rooted belief that, excepting only Savannah, most of the gentle blood of the whole continent could be found in that small seaport city, a belief shared largely by Charlestonians. No, Corrine, next year, dear. Then you can stay up for balls and wear grown-up dresses. And what a good time my little pink cheeks will have. Don't pout, dear. You can go to the barbecue, remember that, and stay up through supper, but no balls till you are 14. Give me your gown, Scarlet. I will whip the lace for you after prayers. So, Ellen, I do not like your tone, dear. Your pink gown is lovely and suitable to your complexion, as Scarlet's is to hers. But you may wear my garnet necklace tomorrow night. Sue Ellen, behind her mother's back, wrinkled her nose triumphantly at Scarlet, who had been planning to beg the necklace for herself. Scarlet put out her tongue at her. Sue Ellen was an annoying sister with her whining and selfishness, and had it not been for Ellen's restraining hand, Scarlet would frequently have boxed her ears. "Now, Mr. O'Hara, tell me more about what Mr. Calvert said about Charleston," said Ellen. Scarlet knew her mother cared nothing at all about war and politics, and thought them masculine matters about which no lady could intelligently concern herself. But it gave Gerald pleasure to air his views, and Ellen was unfailingly thoughtful of her husband's pleasure. While Gerald launched forth on his news, Mammy set the plates before her mistress, golden-topped biscuits, breast of fried chicken, and a yellow yam open and steaming, with melted butter dripping from it. Mammy pinched small Jack, and he hastened to his business of slowly swishing the paper ribbons back and forth behind Ellen. Mammy stood beside the table, watching every forkful that traveled from plate to mouth, as though she intended to force the food down Ellen's throat should she see signs of flagging. Ellen ate diligently. But Scarlet could see that she was too tired to know what she was eating. Only Mammy's implacable face forced her to it. When the dish was empty, and Gerald only midway in his remarks on the thievishness of Yankees, who wanted to free darkies and yet offered no penny to pay for their freedom, Ellen rose.
"We'll be having prayers?" he questioned reluctantly.
"Yes. It is so late. Why, it is actually 10 o'clock," as the clock with coughing and tinny thumps marked the hour. "Corrine should have been asleep long ago. The lamp, please, Pork. And my prayer book, Mammy."
Prompted by Mammy's hoarse whisper, Jack set his fly brush in the corner and removed the dishes, while Mammy fumbled in the sideboard drawer for Ellen's worn prayer book. Pork, tiptoeing, reached the ring in the chain and drew the lamp slowly down until the tabletop was brightly bathed in light and the ceiling receded into shadows. Ellen arranged her skirts and sank to the floor on her knees, laying the open prayer book on the table before her and clasping her hands upon it. Gerald knelt beside her, and Scarlet and Sue Ellen took their accustomed places on the opposite side of the table, folding their voluminous petticoats in pads under their knees so that they would ache less from contact with the hard floor. Corrine, who was small for her age, could not kneel comfortably at the table and so knelt facing a chair, her elbows on the seat. She liked this position, for she seldom failed to go to sleep during prayers, and in this posture, it escaped her mother's notice. The house servant shuffled and rustled in the hall to kneel by the doorway, Mammy groaning aloud as she sank down, Pork straight as a ramrod. Rosa and Tina, the maids, graceful in their spreading bright calicoes, Cookie gaunt and yellow beneath her snowy head rag, and Jack, stupid with sleep, as far away from Mammy's pinching fingers as possible.
Their dark eyes gleamed expectantly, for praying with their white folks was one of the events of the day. The old and colourful phrases of the litany with its oriental imagery meant little to them, but it satisfied something in their hearts, and they always swayed when they chanted the responses. Lord, have mercy on us. Christ, have mercy on us. Ellen closed her eyes and began praying, her voice rising and falling, lulling and soothing. Heads bowed in the circle of yellow light as Ellen thanked God for the health and happiness of her home, her family, and her Negroes. When she had finished her prayers for those beneath the roof of Tara, her father, mother, sisters, three dead babies, and all the poor souls in purgatory, she clasped her white beads between long fingers and began the rosary. Like the rushing of a soft wind, the responses from black throats and white throats rolled back. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Despite her heartache and the pain of unshed tears, a deep sense of quiet and peace fell upon Scarlet, as it always did at this hour. Some of the disappointment of the day and the dread of the morrow departed from her, leaving a feeling of hope. It was not the lifting up of her heart to God that brought this balm, for religion went no more than lip-deep with her. It was the sight of her mother's serene face upturned to the throne of God and his saints and angels, praying for blessings on those whom she loved. When Ellen intervened with heaven, Scarlet felt certain that heaven heard. Ellen finished, and Gerald, who could never find his beads at prayer time, began furtively counting his decade on his fingers. As his voice droned on, Scarlet's thoughts strayed, in spite of herself. She knew she should be examining her conscience. Ellen had taught her that at the end of each day it was her duty to examine her conscience thoroughly, to admit her numerous faults and pray to God for forgiveness and strength, never to repeat them. But Scarlet was examining her heart. She dropped her head upon her folded hands so that her mother could not see her face, and her thoughts went sadly back to Ashley. How could he be planning to marry Melanie when he really loved her, Scarlet? And when he knew how much she loved him, how could he deliberately break her heart? Then, suddenly, an idea, shining anew, flashed like a comet through her brain. Why, Ashley hasn't an idea that I'm in love with him. She almost gasped aloud in the shock of its unexpectedness. Her mind stood still as if paralyzed for a long, breathless instant, and then raced forward. How could he know? I've always acted so prissy and ladylike, and touch me not around him. He probably thinks I don't care a thing about him except as a friend. Yes, that's why he's never spoken. He thinks his love is hopeless, and that's why he's looked so... Her mind went swiftly back to those times when she had caught him looking at her in that strange manner, when the grey eyes that were such perfect curtains for his thoughts had been wide and naked, and had in them a look of torment and despair. He's been broken-hearted because he thinks I'm in love with Brent, a Stuart, a Cade, and probably he thinks that if he can't have me, he might as well please his family and marry Melanie. But if he knew I did love him... Her volatile spirit shot up from deepest depression to excited happiness. This was the answer to Ashley's reticence, to his strange conduct. He didn't know. Her vanity leaped to the aid of her desire to believe, making belief a certainty. If he knew she loved him, he would hasten to her side. She had only to... Oh, she thought rapturously, digging her fingers into her lowered brow. What a fool I've been not to think of this till now. I must think of some way to let him know. He wouldn't marry her if he knew I loved him. How could he? With a start, she realized that Gerald had finished and her mother's eyes were on her. Hastily she began her decade, telling off the beads automatically, but with a depth of emotion in her voice that caused Mammy to open her eyes and shoot a searching glance at her. As she finished her prayers and Sue Ellen, then Corrine, began their decades, her mind was still speeding onward with her entrancing new thought. Even now, it wasn't too late. Too often the county had been scandalized by elopements when one or the other of the participating parties was practically at the altar with a third. And Ashley's engagement had not even been announced yet. Yes, there was plenty of time. If no love lay between Ashley and Melanie, but only a promise given long ago, then why wasn't it possible for him to break that promise and marry her? Surely he would do it, if he knew that she, Scarlet, loved him. She must find some way to let him know. She would find some way. And then Scarlet came abruptly out of her dream of delight, for she had neglected to make the responses, and her mother was looking at her reprovingly. As she resumed the ritual, she opened her eyes briefly and cast a quick glance around the room. The kneeling figures, the soft glow of the lamp, the dim shadows where the Negro swayed, even the familiar objects that had been so hateful to her sight an hour ago, in an instant, took on the color of her own emotions, and the room seemed once more a lovely place. She would never forget this moment, or this scene. "Virgin, most faithful," her mother intoned. The litany of the Virgin was beginning, and obediently Scarlet responded, "Pray for us." As Ellen praised in soft contralto the attributes of the Mother of God. As always, since childhood, this was, for Scarlet, a moment for adoration of Ellen, rather than the Virgin. Sacrilegious though it might be, Scarlet always saw, through her closed eyes, the upturned face of Ellen, and not the Blessed Virgin, as the ancient phrases were repeated. Health of the sick, seat of wisdom, refuge of sinners, mystical rose. They were beautiful words, because they were the attributes of Ellen. But tonight, because of the exaltation of her own spirit, Scarlet found in the whole ceremonial, the softly spoken words, the murmur of the responses, a surpassing beauty beyond any that she had ever experienced before. And her heart went up to God in sincere thankfulness that a pathway for her feet had been opened, out of her misery, and straight into the arms of Ashley. When the last Amen sounded, they all rose, somewhat stiffly, Mammy being hauled to her feet by the combined efforts of Tina and Rosa. Pork took a long spiller from the mantelpiece, lit it from the lamp flame, and went into the hall. Opposite the winding stairs stood a walnut sideboard, too large for use in the dining room, bearing on its wide top several lamps and a long row of candles in candlesticks. Pork lit one lamp and three candles, and, with the pompous dignity of a first chamberlain of the royal bedchamber lighting a king and queen to their rooms, he led the procession up the stairs, holding the light high above his head. Ellen, on Gerald's arm, followed him, and the girls, each taking her own candlestick, mounted after them. Scarlet entered her room, set the candle on the tall chest of drawers, and fumbled in the dark closet for the dancing dress that needed stitching. Throwing it across her arm, she crossed the hall quietly. The door of her parents' bedroom was slightly ajar, and before she could knock, Ellen's voice, low but stern, came to her ears. "Mr. O'Hara, you must dismiss Jonas Wilkerson." Gerald exploded. "And where will I be getting another overseer who wouldn't be cheating me out of me eye teeth?" "He must be dismissed immediately, tomorrow morning. Big Sam is a good foreman, and he can take over the duties until you can hire another overseer." "Aha!" came Gerald's voice. "So, I understand. Then the worthy Jonas sired the—" He must be dismissed.
So, he is the father of Emmy Slattery's baby, thought Scarlet. Oh, well, what else can you expect from Yankee man and white trash girl?
Then, after a discreet pause which gave Gerald's splutterings time to die away, she knocked on the door and handed the dress to her mother. By the time Scarlet had undressed and blown out the candle, her plan for tomorrow had worked itself out in every detail. It was a simple plan, for with Gerald's single-mindedness of purpose, her eyes were centered on the goal, and she thought only of the most direct steps by which to reach it. First, she would be prideful, as Gerald had commanded. From the moment she arrived at Twelve Oaks, she would be her gayest, most spirited self. No one would suspect that she had ever been downhearted because of Ashley and Melanie, and she would flirt with every man there. That would be cruel to Ashley, but it would make him yearn for her all the more. She wouldn't overlook a man of marriageable age from ginger-whiskered old Frank Kennedy, who was Sue Ellen's beau, on down to shy, quiet, blushing Charles Hamilton, Melanie's brother. They would swarm around her like bees around a hive, and certainly Ashley would be drawn from Melanie to join the circle of her admirers. Then, somehow, she would maneuver to get a few minutes alone with him, away from the crowd. She hoped everything would work out that way, because it would be more difficult otherwise. But if Ashley didn't make the first move, she would simply have to do it herself. When they were finally alone, he would have fresh in his mind the picture of the other men thronging about her. He would be newly impressed with the fact that every one of them wanted her, and that look of sadness and despair would be in his eyes. Then she would make him happy again, by letting him discover that, popular though she was, she preferred him above any other man in all the world. And when she admitted it, modestly and sweetly, she would look a thousand things more. Of course, she would do it all in a ladylike way. She wouldn't even dream of saying to him boldly that she loved him. That would never do. But the manner of telling him was a detail that troubled her not at all. She had managed such situations before, and she could do it again. Lying in the bed with the moonlight streaming dimly over her, she pictured the whole scene in her mind. She saw the look of surprise and happiness that would come over his face when he realized that she really loved him, and she heard the words he would say, asking her to be his wife. Naturally, she would have to say then that she simply couldn't think of marrying a man when he was engaged to another girl. But he would insist, and finally, she would let herself be persuaded. Then they would decide to run off to Jonesboro that very afternoon, and why, by this time tomorrow night, she might be Mrs. Ashley Wilkes. She sat up in bed, hugging her knees, and for a long, happy moment, she was Mrs. Ashley Wilkes, Ashley's bride. Then a slight chill entered her heart. Suppose it didn't work out this way. Suppose Ashley didn't beg her to run away with him. Resolutely, she pushed the thought from her mind. "I won't think of that now," she said firmly. "If I think of it now, it will upset me. There's no reason why things won't come out the way I want them. If he loves me, and I know he does." She raised her chin, and her pale, black-fringed eyes sparkled in the moonlight. Ellen had never told her that desire and attainment were two different matters. Life had not taught her that the race was not to the swift. She lay in the silvery shadows with courage rising and made the plans that a 16-year-old makes when life has been so pleasant that defeat is an impossibility, and a pretty dress and a clear complexion are weapons to vanquish fate.